The reading you just heard presents Jesus' first sermon back at his home parish, his home synagogue in Nazareth. I was still in seminary when I gave my first sermon in my home parish at St. Anne's, Atlanta, and I'm pretty sure no one remembers what I said, least of all me, which is, I'm sure, a good thing. But I am sure I met all three criteria for a bad sermon from a joke my father always told. It's the one about, I've mentioned it before, about the young curate finally gives his first sermon, and afterwards he asks the old priest, "Well, what did you think? Do you have any comments?" He said, "I only have three critiques. One, you read it. Two, you didn't read it well. And three, it wasn't worth reading." Jesus' sermon at least overcame those handicaps as we have it today. And what he's doing, he's outlining his agenda for his ministry, for his life. And he takes it from an Old Testament sermon found in the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, probably first spoken 500 or more years before the time of Jesus. And he uses that for his agenda. So that should tell us that the Old Testament is, number one, the only Bible Jesus ever had. That's first to see. And that the old belief sometimes you'll hear among Christians today, well, the Old Testament's law and judgment, the New Testament is grace and love. That's simply wrong. The Old Testament tells the story of God's covenant, God coming to claim God's people, setting them free. And everything is built on the unconditional love of God and not on Israel's ability to do the law. And in the passage Jesus quotes, it is clear that God is promising to come to his people not because they finally became perfect, but because God is doing a new thing. There's a new exodus happening to save the beloved children of Israel and through them to save the world. Now in Jesus and Jesus' ministry, God is showing up to do what God promised 500 years ago and intended from the salvation, from the foundation of the world. You can see that in Ephesians 1:3. And remember, Jesus embodies this agenda in his stories about a shepherd who searches for a lost sheep, and about a woman who tears up her house to find a lost coin, and about the father who waits anxiously for the return of a lost son. And then Jesus fleshed out his talk with his walk and going to just those people who were caught in their suffering. He's acting out his agenda, fleshing it out. And next week we have the second half of the sermon. But today we just want to focus on this agenda because Jesus has the same agenda for us, for him, today. Now, I guess, certainly for me, a major problem we have with this kind of agenda is we have trouble grasping the enormity of the grace that he is presenting. Eddie Snipes used to say that to understand the immensity of God's grace is the same problem we have trying to understand the immensity of a mountain by just looking at a little picture. I had seen countless pictures of the great three peaks of the Grand Teton National Park, which is a fabulous place, but I did not understand their grandeur until my son and I hiked up Table Mountain up to 11,000 feet, and right from there, it looks like you can reach over and touch those magnificent peaks. Of course, the hike up was literally breathtaking for me. My son gave me the compliment of figuring I'd make it, and he just kept going, and I'd walk 10 steps and stop, and then walk 10 steps. But when we got up there, the view was breathtaking. And you can think about plenty of times in your lives where the reality overwhelms any two-dimensional picture. It is said once that during the Second World War, an American soldier ran into Pablo Picasso and commented to the great French painter that, you know, he didn't like his work because it didn't look like reality. And Picasso said, "Well, do you have a picture of your girlfriend?" He said, "Yeah, I've got one in my wallet." And he showed him the picture and he said, "Is she as small as this?" Our pictures of grace become tiny when we run or get run over by the real thing. Grace, of course, comes in every moment of our lives and in the form of our life, in our love, and in being part of this amazing creation. But we're often too busy to notice. And even when we've had experiences of deep grace, and all of you've had those experiences, or you wouldn't be here on a cold Sunday morning. Even when we've had them, after time passes, we tend to forget and we go back to our default setting of wanting God to be about judgment and about fair play. There's a voice in us that says of Jesus' agenda, so God's going to let all the prisoners go? What about the crimes they've committed? Aren't they going to have to atone for their crimes? You can't let guilty people off the hook without punishment. They won't learn a thing. They'll just start doing it again. You can't announce the year of the Lord's favor to good people and bad people as if they were the same. That's not fair. And yet, we remember that story Jesus told about the workers in the vineyard, how the ones who worked an hour in the cool of the evening got paid a full daily wage, just like the people that had been there 8 o'clock in the morning and worked the whole day in the hot Palestinian sun. Is this fair? No. Is it a sign of God's mercy and grace? Yes. Can you build a sound economic system on it? No. Can God build a new human community with such grace? Yes. In fact, that's the only way to build a sustainable human community. I think I'm surely I've mentioned before, Tony Campolo, retired sociology professor from Eastern University, a lay preacher. Go on YouTube and just Google him and listen to him, because reading what he says or hearing me say it is not nearly as much fun as hearing him say it. But he was in a greasy spoon in Honolulu at 3:30 one morning when in walked 8 or 9 prostitutes, came in, sat at a table, and they were loud and boisterous, and he could hear them talking. He heard one of them say that tomorrow was her birthday, and another said, well, you don't expect me to give you a party, do you? And she said, oh no, I just wanted you to know. She said, as a matter of fact, I've never had a birthday party. After they left, Tony asked the guy behind the counter, a guy named Harry, if he knows them, and do they come here every night? And he said, yeah, pretty much. So the next night, Tony, with the help of Harry and Harry's wife, decorate the diner, bake a cake, put the candles in, and when this woman, her name was Agnes, comes in, they sing her happy birthday for the first time in her life. She was so shocked, she said, I've just got to take this cake and go home and show it to my son, because he's never seen one either. After the women left, Tony just spontaneously offered a prayer for those women, for their salvation, their healing, their blessing them. And the guy behind the counter said, oh, so you're a preacher. What kind of church do you belong to? And he said, I belong to a church that throws birthday parties for whores at 3:30 in the morning. Harry waited a moment and then he sneered, no, you don't, because there's no church like that. If there was, I'd join it. I'd join a church like that. And Tony went on to say, well, wouldn't we all? Well, that's exactly the kind of church Jesus came to create. On your way home, as you think about that story, you may have a problem with it. You may think, well, the only way to fix one's life is you've got to go back into someone's past and get that all straightened out and get all those problems worked out. And this makes sense to us, so we spend individually enormous amounts of time rehashing our own past, right? Our own failings that keep coming back, and then we think maybe if we just stew about it another month or another 10 years, that somehow it's going to magically blossom and produce something beautiful. Back in the day, back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you could go see your psychoanalyst 3-4 times a week for 10 years and just talk about your past all you wanted. Just wade through the muck. But this is not how God's healing works, because God is not limited by our past. I like the way Karl Barth puts it. Jesus does not first look at your past and then look at your tragic present in the light of it, but from your present, he creates for you a new future. Jesus announces God's agenda to bring a new future into a new present through the grace of God. And that's what the church is. That's what the church is. Christ's body acting out his agenda among people who don't deserve grace.